We're in Clare College, Cambridge, for episode 3 of season 2 of Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with History Today, the world's leading serious history magazine. I'm Peter Moore. Welcome to Travels Through Time. Today we're going to be going back to 1918, to a Western world in turmoil with war, and to see what this meant for an extraordinary generation of women. If I asked you to picture in your mind a typical suffragist, a figure like Emmeline Pankhurst might well spring to mind, elegant and precisely dressed, but willing to slash a pitcher or to smash a window for the cause. It's a powerful vision, but it's also one that obscures as much as it enlightens. What about the other pioneering women from this time? The surgeons, the chemical researchers, the aeroplane designers. Today's guest is going to take us to meet three of these remarkable women at work in the year 1918. Dr. Patricia Farrer is a fellow of Clare College, Cambridge. She's recently served as president for the British Society for the History of Science, and she's written widely on the subject, from her prize-winning Science, a 4,000-year history, to works on Isaac Newton and Carl Linnaeus. In this episode, she talks about the characters at the heart of her latest book, A Lab of One's Own, a stirringly original survey of women, science, and suffrage in the period of the First World War. I met up with Patricia in a little tutorial room in Clare College the other day. First of all, I want you to tell me a little bit about this book, A Lab of One's Own. It's a great title. I think we know what it's playing against. Another famous book with that name. But what have you tried to do in that book?
Well, I think the best way to tell you is why I was inspired to write it, because normally I'm an 18th century historian, and I just happened to be in the archives of Newnham College, which is still one of the women's only colleges in Cambridge. And the archivist showed me a gorgeous book. It was handmade. It had linen covers with an embroidered crest on. And inside, two women had lettered in beautiful, beautiful black and red handwriting. They'd listed all the women who'd been at Newnham and had played a part during the First World War. And I looked through it, and of course I found lots of nurses and ambulance drivers and committee members and people who'd made the tea and sandwiches. I was expecting all that. What I hadn't anticipated is that the first few pages are full of women who were ballistics experts, who were carrying out experiments on vitamins, who were doctors in France and in Serbia. And I just wanted to find out more about these women and who they were. So I went to the university library, which of course is what every academic does, and found there was nothing on these women at all, because most of the books are about science in the First World War, and obviously there were far more men than women. They're about all the factory workers, the munitionettes, and the ambulance drivers, and I wanted to look at this really small group of women who were qualified scientists, doctors, and engineers, and they were very, very active during the First World War and also in the suffrage movement, and so that's what I've written about.
Interesting. I think there's been a tremendous amount of work on the suffrage movement over the last few years. And why do you think these particular people, I'm thinking of the ones whose names are in the book that you found, why have they been obscured?
One of the reasons these women have been obscured is that there are very, very few of them. And it was very difficult to find out the information. They left very little traces behind. Of course, a lot of them were involved in secret work. So that was another reason why there's little information about them. But in general, I think it's a phenomenon in history that we know lots and lots of stuff about men and not about women. They tend to get obscured from the record. There's another reason why I wanted to write this book, because I'm sure that in houses and archives all over the country, there's women's diaries stashed away. And I hope people are going to read those, and I hope they're going to realise that their grandmothers or great aunts were also involved in this war effort. I was doing things like taking books out of the library that nobody'd read for 50 years, because you can tell that from the record at the front.
So a hint that I picked up of some of these stories from your book, you say that in 1919, 648 women
applied for patents for their own ideas. And while many of them concerned improvements in domestic devices, mm-hmm. women were also filing patents for inventions related to aeroplanes, telegraphy, and marine engines. So that's just a taste, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, during the war, in Imperial College in London, there was an experimental trench dug in the garden, and there was an 8-woman team down there. The woman in charge was called Martha Whiteley. She tested mustard gas and she developed an explosive, and the explosive was codenamed DW for Dr. Whiteley. So yes, women were doing all sorts of things like that.
Okay, well, 1918 is the year we've chosen to explore, or to travel back to, I should say. Of course, it's a really important year in terms of women's history. Do you want to tell us why?
Oh, well, it's an important year in terms of women's history because this is when women over 30 got the vote. It's also an important year in terms of the war. And I think it'd be impossible to talk about 1918 without mentioning those two events. But what I've tried to do is choose episodes which are slightly to one side and slightly less known about. I think by 1918, this war had been going on for an awful long time, and it didn't seem as though there was an end in sight. And the war eclipsed every other achievement, so that when there was a new invention or when it seemed that something like the women's vote was going to arrive, actually that didn't seem terribly important compared with the war. There was this very united feeling of opposing the Germans and gaining independence, but also the women themselves were divided. I mean, a lot of women were very, very keen on doing everything they could to support the war effort. And the suffrage activity more or less stopped during the war because these women wanted to fight for their nation. But there was another substantial group of women who were very keen on getting the vote, but they were also pacifists. And they thought that it was in women's nature to be peaceful, and they were determined not to engage in any patriotic activity that involved warfare against other countries. So there were a lot of divisions, even amongst the suffragists. They had different tactics, different feelings about the way forward.
But what I suppose coloured the whole mood was what Wade Davis has called the long hallucination of the war, which induced a universal torpor and melancholy, a sense of isolation, a loss of centre, a restless desire to move.
But for all the women who were doctors and lawyers and civil servants, they had to work for their living, and they were getting paid two-thirds what men were getting paid for doing the same job. And yes, it was marvellous having the vote. What they really wanted was financial and economic equality.
Well, that's, I think, got us poised perfectly. So we're going to go and have a look at 1918 through these three different scenes. And the first one you've chosen happens on the 10th of January, 1918, the House of Lords of Westminster. What's happening?
Right. I want you to imagine you're in a small committee room in the House of Lords. You're there with a group of other women, because, of course, as women, you can't go into the House of Lords itself. And it's the third day of the debate about the Representation of the People Bill, giving more men and more women the vote. So you're sitting there, it's just after lunch on the third day of the debate, and a policeman pops his head round the door and he says, "Well, ladies, it's Lord Curzon coming up now." And the women look at each other and they're absolutely terrified, because they know that this is the peak of the debate. Lord Curzon, former Viceroy of India, was the leader of the House of Commons, but he was also the president of the Anti-Suffrage League. So what he said was going to be really important. And he amazed everybody. He stood up in the House of Lords and he came out with all the standard stuff about women are absolutely hopeless and we shouldn't give them the vote, all that stuff. And then, to his credit, he said, "Well, in the House of Commons, there was a majority of 350 to get this bill through." And he said, "We're the House of Lords and I don't think we should go against the House of Commons." And he himself abstained. But there was quite a substantial majority in the House of Lords. And I think, considering all the debates we're going through at the moment about parliamentary democracy, this seems to be quite an interesting example of Lord Curzon telling the country what to do, but it was something that he personally did not believe in and that he thought was wrong.
So to clarify, it's just the moment when these people watching on realise that this is going to become law, this is going to pass through the houses, or do you think...
Obviously the bill had already been in the House of Commons the previous June. And then In the House of Commons, it was rebuilt after the fire in the 1840s, and there was a ladies' gallery upstairs, and there were loads of women crammed into that gallery. What they really objected to was that there was a grill, and so when they couldn't really see through it properly, and it was very hot and stuffy, and they were sort of like animals caged behind this grill. And later on, they put in a petition to get rid of this grill. They were very, very clever about it, because what they did was they approached all the wives of the MPs, and they got something like 264, I think it was, 264 wives signed the petition to remove the grill. And when it was the day of the vote, these MPs, they all came down to breakfast at home, and their wives had left this signed petition next to their breakfast plate. So the message was pretty clear that if you want more breakfast, you better vote to get rid of this grill.
Wow, this is a clever way of operating, I think.
And it went through and the grill was removed. But then, that day in June, a lot of the suffrage women had been up behind the grill, getting all hot and sticky, but they had seen the House of Commons vote with a majority of 350 for it to go through. So they knew it was just a question of time, but they were worried that the House of Lords might delay it further, but they didn't.
So I suppose there's a sense of release, and as you say at the moment, it makes it all the easier for us to put ourselves in that situation, because we're watching pieces of legislation creeping back and forth between the two houses at the moment and wondering which is going to pass and which is going to fall and which is going to be delayed and which is going to roar through and charge off into the world.
There had been a long build-up to this event in 1918, and one of the reasons the government agreed to do it was because they realised in 1916 that because so many men were away at war, the next time there was an election, there wouldn't be enough people to vote. So they needed to beef up the number of people who were allowed to vote. But they only allowed women over 30 to vote because they thought they were more likely to vote in a sort of very conservative establishment sort of way. They didn't want any of these young, independent women who'd been in the factories. They didn't want them to get the vote.
Okay, so if we're in this committee room,
yes,
watching on, you say it's crammed full of women who are watching this.
Well, they're not watching them, not allowed to watch. That's why they're in a separate committee room.
No,
that's why the policeman came in to tell them Lord Curzon is on now.
Yeah.
So they had to sit there and wait until someone came back to tell them what the vote had been.
So which figures would be in that room on that day?
Well, one of the women that I'm particularly interested in is a woman called Ray Strachey, and I'm interested in her because she was a mathematician. She's got a degree in maths from Cambridge. She then studied engineering at Oxford. I'm also very interested in her. She was a leading suffrage campaigner. But one thing which strikes me as extraordinary is that there is such an industry in the Bloomsbury set. And this woman, Ray Costello, her name was, and her sister Karen. Ray Costello married one of the Strachies, and her sister Karen married one of the Stevens. So these two sisters are right at the centre of the two major families of the Bloomsbury set, the Strachies and the Stevens. And yet virtually nothing is ever heard of them.
But she was right at the centre of that Bloomsbury.
She even lived in Bloomsbury Square.
And you're reminding me, of course, in the book of Dorothy Parker's famous saying, what is it? The Bloomsbury set lived in squares, painted in circles, and loved
in triangles. Well, yeah. She and her husband certainly lived in triangles.
So if you get, of course, Strachey might be a name that's familiar to people from
Lytton Strachey. So she married Lytton Strachey's younger brother, Oliver.
So let's go and spend a bit of time with her, because she sounds like a fascinating character. So she's very well educated. How involved in the suffrage movement is she?
Oh, she was absolutely central to it. She more or less ran the NUWSS, the largest women's union. There's marvellous quotations from her about how she was in and out of parliamentary committee meetings the whole time. She was an excellent committee woman, and she was sort of wheeling and dealing with Philippa Strachey. The two of them together really made sure that this bill got through. And the minute the war was declared in 1914, the union set up an employment bureau in Victoria Street, and she was very active there. And what they did was find jobs for women And they looked after the Belgian refugees. And then she set up, for example, a welding school so that women could learn to be professional welders and they could replace the men, but do it in a very professional, skilled way. They weren't just amateurs. They knew how to do it properly. Mm. She was also very involved in trade union activity because the unions were male and they were quite often very opposed to the women coming in and taking over their jobs in the factories during the war. And there were lots of debates about whether the women should be paid the same as the men. And then in the factories, they introduced new machinery because for the very heavy physical work, that was impossible for the women to do. So they brought in new machinery. But then, of course, after the war, the factory owners expected the men to meet the same higher production rates that the women had met. So there was lots and lots of debates about that. So the suffragists and the trade unions were constantly at loggerheads because the trade unions were supporting their members' rights and the women were against them.
Race strikes you, the thing you mentioned before, and what I read about in the book that really fascinated me was her connection with Virginia Woolf, who really is a towering figure
yes.
in 20th century modern literature. Most people will be familiar with her. Lots of people will have read her work. I think you make the point of one part of your book that at this point, or maybe a few years later at least, Ray Strachey had probably the bigger reputation of the two. She was a well-published writer in her own right.
A Room of One's Own came out in 1929, I believe. And nobody had really heard of Virginia Woolf then, but everybody knew Ray Strachey because as she'd stood to be an MP, she was a leading suffragist, she went everywhere giving talks, she'd published loads and loads of books. And her book called The Cause, for about the next 50 years, it was the major history of the women's suffrage movement going back to the Victorian era. It was a comprehensive history. She was very well known. She and Virginia Woolf did not get on very well. They'd known each other since they were teenagers. And she went to stay with Virginia Stephen, as she was then. So you've got Ray Costello and Virginia Stephen. And Ray Costello wrote back to her mother and said, "These Bloomsbury people, Virginia's friends, they're terribly strange. They keep barking like dogs and racing around on the sofa. And they don't really seem to do very much." So, but from her perspective, Virginia thought Ray was quite big and clumsy, and she accused her of not being interested in clothes, which she wasn't. She was deliberately unfashionable because she thought there were more important things to be getting on with.
Mm. Yeah, you've got a picture right at the beginning of your book of her in the cricket team, have you not?
Oh, she's at Newnham.
This is at Newnham, like before the war, and she was wearing.
She was at Newnham about 1909, something like that. She was absolutely committed to mathematics. She loved mathematics, but she was captain of the cricket team. And she also, with her best friend, Ellie Rendell, who was Lytton Strachey's niece, they set up a suffrage society at Newnham, and then it extended right through the university. So she didn't get a very good degree, and I imagine it was because she spent some of her time playing cricket, but she also put enormous energy into this suffrage movement. And after the war, she went on all the marches, and she was very much engaged in all
of
that.
There's another nice quote. She, as the principal of Somerville College, remarked, she was someone who took up lost causes and they ceased to be lost.
Yes, which it's great. Yeah.
It's a nice way of putting it. Can we just talk about her as a mathematician for a moment?
Yes.
Because we've looked here at her in this room and she's central to the politics of the time. Mm. But that's almost just one thing she was doing. The mathematics was something she was extraordinarily serious about as well.
Her aunt was president of Bryn Mawr University in America. And she wrote to her aunt several letters and also entries in her diary from when she was a little girl about how beautiful mathematics is. And I think she liked to sort of lose herself in that sort of abstract world where everything fits together nicely. And by the time, just before finals, she was writing to her aunt saying, "I still absolutely, absolutely love maths. I just don't think I'm very good at it."
Okay, let's leave January, or the 10th of January in the House of Lords behind, and go on to the second scene, which is a few months later, the 26th of March. Mm-hmm. So Mad March hares are running round the fields of Britain this time, I imagine. What's going on the 26th of March that you would like to go back and see? And we'll talk about it in a minute.
Well, the 26th of March, 1918, inside the military hospital at Hampstead in London, there's a man, aged 39, who's just come back from the war and he broke his ankle. So he's in the hospital and he is visited by a woman called Mary Stopes. And at this stage, the main attachment between them is financial. He was a very wealthy man called Rowe, Humphrey Rowe, and he had invested in a book by Mary Stopes called Married Love, which he'd written 5 years earlier. Nobody would publish it because it was so scandalous. He financed the publication and it came out on that day, the 26th of March.
So this is the date of publication.
The date of publication. And he unexpectedly comes back with a broken ankle. She hadn't expected to see him. So she goes round to see him in the hospital and they start talking about it. And then within a few days, she has decided that she's very keen on this man and she starts moving in on him. And there's one slight inconvenience is that he is already engaged to somebody else. So then she embarked on a campaign to get rid of the other woman. And then by the end of May, so it's only a couple of months later, they got married secretly.
Quite a story and quite a book at the centre of the story.
Well, the whole point of Married Love, it's an educational book. It's written in very romantic, flowery language. It's actually not very specific about physical details, but the level of general ignorance about women's bodies, both anatomically and physiologically, was absolutely enormous at that stage. And she wanted to reduce the levels of ignorance. The first sentence gives the flavour of the book, "Every heart desires its mate." Mm. And she had this beautifully flowery euphemism for what happens during marriage. One of the many strange things about this book is that when she wrote it, she was actually a virgin. By her own testimony, she'd already been married to somebody else and she'd filed for the divorce on the grounds of non-consummation. And then the night that she married Humphrey Rowe secretly, she wrote to another man and said, "The marriage has been consummated." I don't think it went very well because she wrote after that something like, "Well, I'm sure in future it'll be far more wonderful than it was last night."
Well, there's some places we can't go with imagination, but there's...
No, but I think it's very interesting. This book that was an overnight bestseller, it sold about, I think, several thousand books in the first couple of weeks. It sold all over the English-speaking world, and it had another resurgence in sales after the Second World War.
And went on for millions.
Yes, millions it sold. And there's a huge archive in the Wellcome Library at London of grateful letters that people wrote to men as well as women, because they just did not know. It's extraordinary now to think of it. They just did not know. Basically what we've now called the basic facts of life. There was huge ignorance and people were very grateful. A lot of people really disapproved of this book being published, even though it was very non-specific in
its
details.
There's so much for us to analyse here, because we looked at Ray Strach. He's a fascinating character.
Yeah.
And Marie Stopes is someone that we really need to look at biographically as well to make sense of her story, I think, because it's a book, well, this book in particular, this is years before the National Health Service, isn't it?
Oh, yes, that was 1948. The other interesting thing is about, she wasn't a doctor. She was a paleobotanist. She specialised in fossil plants. And she was a very, very clever woman who got a degree in 2 years instead of three. And at Manchester University, she was their first female lecturer. And she stayed there for several years. And at the time of the war, when this book came out, she was doing research into coal. And she'd spent a year and a half in Japan on a research fellowship. I mean, she was becoming a very eminent scientist. She was already very well known.
And her story, though, it's a picture, a changing picture, isn't it? Because I've spent time looking at science in the 19th century over the years. And and it's really striking when you do that, how it's very male. And if there's a mention at all, I'm thinking of people like John Tyndall, James Glacier, these kind of people, if they mention their wife at all, it's one, very rare, two, that usually comes at the very end of a report, and thank you to my wife for, you know, tidying up afterwards or something like this. So they're very obscured, even though they were very active sometimes. Then you've got this amazing photograph of Mary Stopes when she's right in the centre of the picture. And if you're going to have one picture for a lab of one's own, that's almost the one that I thought.
Oh, yes, and she's got a great flask behind her.
She almost seems in the centre. And she, on the title page, she lists all of her qualifications and she has endorsements from other scientists. So she's presenting herself maybe it's someone who's a lucid writer and willing to tackle maybe slightly taboo subjects, but she's doing it from a position of authority.
Absolutely. And she also did include graphs showing sort of female cycles, which was something that, people were completely ignorant of. So she did give it a sort of scientific aura. She actually got quite a lot of it wrong. And when she didn't know, that's why I think it is relevant that she basically didn't know what she was talking about. There's also the story of why she was inspired to write it. When she was at university, she was talking to a young medical student, a young woman, and this woman had been in a clinic, and a woman had come in with a baby who was obviously dying. And she said to the doctor, "Look, this is the third of my babies that's died. Do you think something's wrong with my husband?" And this doctor said, "Oh, no, of course not, absolutely right. Fine, off you go and have more babies." And the student was struck because she could see very clearly that this baby had been born with syphilis. So the man, well, one assumes the man, the husband, had syphilis, and this was sort of being covered over. So Marie Stopes, what she wanted to do was get rid of that ignorance. And she felt that less educated people, poorer people, should have the same access to knowledge that she did as an educated, well-off woman. So it was a very egalitarian incentive.
Yeah, she's identified something really important there. And of course,
it was a taboo subject.
Well, you've got the numbers here. So 17,000 copies were bought in its first year. By 1955, well over 1 million copies had been printed. I'm sure maybe the title, which is eye-catching and probably quite risque at the time.
Absolutely. There was several newspapers who refused to advertise books like that because they were just so scandalous.
Well, I think it's just going back really to look at a moment when a really important work of literature of a type maybe that would become more familiar to the British readership over the next, or the interwar years, was released.
I think to succeed in those days, I mean, you had to have a power of personality. You had to have the resilience. And I think with a lot of these women, although there's the interesting word bossy, which is still very much a word that's applied to women. And a lot of these women, I think, when they were in charge, if they reached the head of department, they were criticised for being too authoritarian. Whereas if a man had been in the same position and behaved in the same way, he would have been described as authoritative. But the women were described as authoritarian, and we see that now in this word bossy, which, I mean, if you're a boss, you've got to be bossy. But it's a word, it's a pejorative word that's only applied to women.
So just to round off this story, this book is an absolutely massive success and continues to be so for so many years. Did that overshadow the work she did subsequently, because she was always remembered as the person who wrote that book?
Oh, absolutely. I was astonished when I found out that she'd been a lecturer at Manchester University. I had absolutely no idea whatsoever. It was brand identification like Hoover and vacuum cleaners. It was Mary Stopes and birth control clinics. Yeah, so I had no idea.
That's a really vivid picture. We're going to go somewhere quite different now.
Yes.
Quite different indeed. And it's the 1st of November 1918. You've got to imagine all of these events, I suppose, happening in parallel to these great military events which are playing out across the continent. Where are we going to go on the 1st of November?
Well, we're going to go to Serbia, a place called Vranje, which is V-R-A-N-J-E. And one thing that's really striking during the commemorations we've had recently in this country of the First World War from 2014 to 18, almost every event focused on the Western Front in France. And we heard everything about that. What we heard very, very, very little about was the Italian Front and also the Eastern Front, which was very long and went through Serbia and up through Bulgaria and up through Russia. And there were huge numbers of our soldiers there. And in addition, there were a lot of women who were doctors and nurses and medical practitioners, and they were on this Eastern Front throughout the war and also afterwards, enduring absolutely appalling conditions. And they are remembered in those countries, in Serbia particularly, but they're not remembered over here. And this movement was initiated by a Scottish doctor called Elsie Ingalls, and she was a very keen suffragist, and she raised a lot of money from the Scottish suffrage organisations as soon as the war started. And she set up two complete hospital trains with ambulances and X-ray machines and bandages and whatever else you need. All the doctors and all the nurses were women. And then she wrote to the War Office and said, look, I've got these two emergency teams that can go out. And the War Office turned around and said, my dear lady, go home and sit still. Our army can't be bothered with having women out on the front. So she was absolutely furious, and she went to all her allies, to France and Russia and Serbia, and they thought this was a wonderful idea. So these teams of women, they went, one team went out to France, another team went out to Serbia, and then throughout the war, all these women were going out to the Western, but mainly to the Eastern Front, all funded by suffrage activity in Great Britain. So one of the women that I want to talk about is a woman called Isabel Emsley. And she wrote, unusually, she wrote a memoir of her experiences because she wanted the war to be remembered not just as fights and battles as politics. She wanted people to know what it was actually like on the ground. And she wrote a long memoir. Reading it is really, really horrific. These women went through the most terrible time. And by the time she went to Vranje, it was 1918, she'd already been out there for 3 years. And the whole area was absolutely rife with diseases like malaria, typhus, typhoid. By this time, the Spanish flu epidemic was rampaging everywhere. It was freezing in the winter, lots of snow, boiling in the summer. And by November the 1st, she'd just been on a long trek for about 5 days through the mountains. She arrived on the 27th of October. She arrived at an old barracks, and it was piled high with, I don't want to go into the gory details too much, but it was piled high with dead bodies, with people who were dying. There was absolutely, absolutely no sanitation. There was no heating. She made this joke that as soon as the British people arrive, the first thing they talk about is lice. The second thing they talk about is latrines. And she got her team of people out there heating the place, cleaning it, putting paraffin over every single surface to get rid of all the insects.
Well, I think that's a wonderful overview, panoramic, and the power of this scene, obviously, is that it's an inversion of everything we think about. If I say November 1918, we have these images that are conjured up in our minds. Generally, you're in France.
Victory marches, fireworks, yeah.
Well, exactly. But it shows that history is obviously far messier than that. Mm. And I mean, why don't we talk about the Eastern Front quite so much? That's an interesting question in itself. Can I throw that one at you?
I imagine because there aren't so many heroic stories. I mean, the women that we do talk about, Edith Cavell and Vera Brittain, they're very, very romanticised stories of these women. And whenever you see them, whenever you see pictures of them, they look rather like nuns because they're wearing sort of white cloths on their head, and they're nurses and they're saviours. And they're it's a bit like Florence Nightingale, they're holding soldiers' hands. Whereas this woman was in, all these women who were out there were incredibly feisty and independent. She was doing surgery. Surgery was a male speciality. When she came back to England after the war, she'd had 4 years of really, really detailed surgery on all sorts of different parts of people's bodies. Yet she wrote that when she came back to England, she said, there's no point in trying to get into surgery because that's a job for men. And that's still the same now. Surgery is still a male speciality. There's very few female surgeons. She doesn't fit the stereotype.
But what you're describing now seems to fit almost with something we were discussing a little while before, which is this change in circumstances during the war is allowing women into spaces which they were prohibited from before. And I know if you go back and read Isabel's story, she wasn't a surgeon when she worked in a mental hospital.
She wasn't allowed to be a surgeon.
But she had this kind of latent ambition, I suppose, to work in surgery. Was only she? In 1916 was she allowed to join and to go and then start practicing. So is my question to you, is that the power and the attraction of this to you, to see someone fulfilling really an ambition of theirs?
Yes,
that they were,
and she loved it. I mean, she wrote back to her mother, look, I'm only 30 and I'm in charge of this whole hospital and I've spent the whole day operating and I'm organising everything and I'm getting it done and I absolutely love it. And she came back and she got married, and then as a married woman, she was no longer allowed to earn a salary as a doctor. So she did practice medicine. She volunteered, but she couldn't go and work in an ordinary hospital because she got married.
And the ridiculous part of that is that the conditions she was working in on the Eastern Front were far worse than anything you would encounter in a peacetime hospital in Great Britain. I mean, you talk about 28, you've given us a little hint, so I want you just to fill in that gap. She went on in the Second World War to be a doctor once again, a surgeon, or is...
Oh, in the Second World War.
You might as well just take the story through.
So in the Second World War, in between the World Wars, she did all sorts of medical work. She was very involved in psychiatry, which was a very new field at that moment. She also, like Mary Stopes, wrote a guidance book for women, but it was much more anatomical and much more precise, and it had diagrams, and it was a fully medical book written in simple terms, but it was medically explicit, which Mary Stopes's book wasn't. And then in the Second World War, her husband was posted to India, and she went out to India with him, and she basically took over the Red Cross in India and did all sorts of good works when she was out there. And a couple of them, they met Mahatma Gandhi, and they had a conversation, and Gandhi looked at her and said how much more important her work was than her husband, because her husband was a soldier and soldier is just butchery, whereas she as a doctor was helping to cure people.
Wow. How is she remembered today? Is she...
She's completely forgotten here. I mean, I imagine you haven't heard of her. In 2014, the anniversary of the First World War, in Serbia, they published a postage stamp which had got a picture of her and her name. The hospital in Vranje, there was a new hospital in the 1970s, that's named after her. A lot of these women who were out in Serbia during this period are regularly remembered there. And we've completely forgotten their existence. And she's marvellous.
It's an incredible story.
She's a wonderful woman.
Wonderful woman. And it's that blend of being supremely practical, confident, get on with things. I know you say she was of a strict Presbyterian background Edinburgh.
Yeah.
I don't know whether any of that comes through here, but it's wonderful just to think back and see someone with a skill like hers working in such an extreme environment as that. So we'll leave that one there.
Okay.
And I think we won't improve on that much more. So at the end of all of these recordings, I ask the same question of all of our guests. If you could bring one tangible object with you back from 1918 to 2019, what would you like?
I would like to have Isabel Emsley's diary, and I would like to read, flinching, I would read the terrible time that she went through. And I know how emotive that would be. I was at LSE in the Women's Library, and I was looking in an archive, and I found a small letter. It was scribbled in pencil, and it was written to Ray Strachey, and it was from a woman who was out there in Serbia, describing how they had nothing to eat except hard-boiled eggs and bread, which was all 8 days old, and she only had a little stub of a candle to see by, and she was writing this in pencil because she didn't have anything else, and it was inside an envelope. And the envelope had censor stamps all over it. And I wondered how it was that this tiny piece of rough paper with scrawled pencil on it had managed to come back in its envelope with all the censor stamps and find its way to LSE. And it was so emotional. So holding it in my hand, I think this woman was out in Serbia when she wrote this letter. It was extraordinary.
That's a real example of the magical and the meaningful that we talk about, isn't it? When you get that connection with a person that's through an object like that.
Yeah.
Brilliant choice. No, it's fine. But what you've done, I suppose, navigated through a year of enormous change and drama from the familiar to the absolutely obscure, because I suppose we can all imagine the House of Lords, but few of us thought about the Eastern Front and Serbia in November of that time. So it's been a pleasure. Can we just, before we finish, talk a little bit more generally about the book? Because I know it's been splendidly reviewed. Congratulations on that. And I think probably why it's caught the imaginations of people is for its originality. I was reading it and just was startled all the time by my ignorance. Who's this person? Who's that person? Why haven't I heard of this person? Because the stories you're telling are important stories, which obviously deserve to be told.
A lot of the material was completely new to me because I'm not a historian of that period. I'm a historian of the 18th century. So I just had an average person's knowledge of the beginning of the 20th century. So I suppose some of that sort of sense of discovery and surprise was also fueling me. By looking at history, by studying the past, you can see how it is that you've reached the present. But I think the most gratifying aspect of that, the most important aspect of that, is to use that knowledge to try to improve the future. One problem they didn't have, which modern women didn't have, is the ones who were rich anyway had nurses to look after the babies. Because one of the biggest problems affecting modern women in science is looking after the children. And the universities and the industries all say they provide childcare, but it's incredibly expensive and very restrictive. It sort of stops at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's absolutely useless. Whereas all these women, they could afford to have two or three live-in nannies. So the children weren't a problem. But for those who were wealthy, and by definition, most of them were, that was one thing that was better.
Well, I'm going to end with two things that you mention in the book. First is an epigraph, which I can't help but mention because I loved it so much, and it's by Elbert Hubbard. You know, this one, you say, he picked up the lemons that fate had sent him and started a lemonade stand.
Yes, and that's what these women,
that's what they were doing, isn't it? And then there's a quote of yours which I think just sets out what you're doing in the book perfectly. Why had I heard of Vera Brittain and Edith Cavell, but not the chemists who were experimenting with explosives and mustard gas in trenches at Imperial College? Why does our country not commemorate the female doctors who ran hospitals under atrocious conditions in Salonika, or the London professor of botany who headed the Women's Army in France? I resolved to create my own tribute to these scientific pioneers who had helped win the war and to gain the vote. It's a wonderful read, Patricia. Thank you very much for taking us through it and through 1918.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Well, that was me, Peter Moore, talking to Dr. Patricia Farah about the year 1918 and some of the remarkable characters from her recent book, A Lab of One's Own. The book's recently been awarded the Cambridgeshire Association for Local History Prize, and it's shortly to be issued in paperback by Oxford University Press. Goodbye.
Hello, I'm Artemis, and I work on the Travels Through Time podcast. Women's lives and work are so often obscured from the historical record, so it was such a pleasure to uncover these women's voices and their crucial contributions to both the suffrage movement and the war effort. I was particularly moved by the observation made about Ray Strachey, as someone who, once they took up a lost cause, it ceased to be lost. It reminded me of so many young activists today, whether their cause is environmental or social. There's lots more expert comment from the Archives of History Today, the world's leading serious history magazine. For example, Sanitising the Suffragettes by Fern Riddle looks at the bombing campaigns of the Women's Social and Political Union. Or in the most recent issue, you can find Eleanor Parker's article, The Cultured Women of Essex, which examines the scholarly women of Barking Abbey in the Middle Ages. They produced a wealth of historical, hagiographical, and literary writing, but they've often been forgotten, much like Patricia Farah's scientists and doctors. I hope that you found this episode stimulating and that you'll join us again next time for some more adventures into the past. We've reverted to our fortnightly schedule, so the next episode will be released on Tuesday, the 8th of October. Then we've a fabulous episode talking to the medieval historian Thomas Penn about 1483, and one of the most notorious kings in English history. That's Richard III, of course. Till then, goodbye.